Welcome to Smart Talk. I'm Scott Lamar, broadcasting from my home studio. Coming up later in the program, it cost Pennsylvania taxpayers more than $3 million to defend against election-related lawsuits. But up front, almost 2.8 million Pennsylvanians have been vaccinated against the COVID-19 virus. 7.1 million first shots have been given. Most see the vaccinations as a hopeful sign that the coronavirus can be controlled. However, almost a third of the state's residents don't plan to get vaccinated at all. Could that make it more difficult? Also, Pennsylvanians are almost evenly split on how Governor Tom Wolf has handled the pandemic, while 54% approve of the job President Joe Biden has done in handling it since he took office. And 61% say it is the federal government's responsibility to make sure all Americans have health care coverage. Those are just a few of the major findings of the 9th annual Muhlenberg College poll on health. Joining us to discuss those findings is Dr. Christopher Burrick, who is professor of political science and director of the Muhlenberg College Institute of Public Opinion. Chris Burrick, welcome to the program. By the way, if you have a question or comment on the results that you hear today, give us a call, 1-800-729-7532. Send an email to smarttalk@witf.org. On Twitter, we are at smarttalkwitf. Chris Burrick, I think we all are looking forward to how and when this pandemic will end. But there are two findings in the poll that make me wonder a little bit. One is that a third say they have no plans to get a vaccination. And number two, 15% say they're not concerned about the virus at all. Now, the good news is 70% do plan to get vaccinated, and more than 80% are extremely very or just concerned about the virus. But it shows that not everyone is on the same page with this. Why not?
Yeah, first of all, good morning, Scott. And indeed, I think the poll results from this year regarding and the questions regarding COVID do show a mixed picture. There's some optimism. We asked people in the state, do they think the worst is behind us? Most do. As you noted, a majority have either the combination of that they've received the vaccination or intend to get vaccinated against COVID. Is incredibly important from a public health perspective. So there are good signs, but as you said, as this issue has evolved over the last year, in many ways it's taken on so much of the same partisan divides that are part of our contemporary social and cultural fabric in the state. And indeed, those issues emerge in terms of things like hesitancy to receive a vaccine. And so yes, once again, politics and partisanship is a big part of another issue in Pennsylvania.
Well, your poll shows that Republicans are much more likely to say they won't get vaccinated and compared to Democrats who responded to the poll. How did this become vaccinations? I mean, how did getting a vaccine become a political issue?
It's a great question. And we've been looking, as you mentioned, this is the 9th year we've done this poll, and obviously that predates COVID. And we've looked historically at questions of immunization, how the public Pennsylvania looks at it, what concerns they have. And there were partisan elements before this in how we viewed it, just like we would have talked, just a little bit ago on the show about climate change perspective. And that's become highly partisanized over time. But the last year, I think, as we saw this issue emerge, the political aspects of it simply became part of the picture as issues about personal freedoms, government roles in our lives started to be woven into the daily discussions about the pandemic and in literally affecting our lives and how we live our lives. It took on tones. We see, like we do so often, the communications, the cues that are coming from elites, if you will, political elites, social elites, others on this issue have reinforced some of that partisanship in how the issue is looked at. But vaccines have now for a long time in America become part of the political debates. And it's probably not incredibly surprising, Scott, that once this particular public health issue that's historic in its nature emerged, that those things would find a way into this discussion too.
And even in your poll this time, you ask people whether vaccinations are safe, and it comes down about the same percentage. 70% say they are. And our vaccines, I should say, are safe. So it comes down to, but it wasn't the exact same people or the same people generally that were saying that they were safe or not safe or deciding to get a vaccination against COVID and not deciding?
Yeah, there actually is a great kind of overlap, if you will, in our general questions about vaccine safety that are not COVID specific that we've asked year after year on this issue. If you look at the individuals that think largely had pre-existing, I guess, concerns about vaccines, that's transferred over to COVID. That individuals that have largely been distrustful of vaccines, of course, are much more likely to be distrustful of the COVID vaccine. And those things do overlay with some of the socio-political factors that we've already discussed.
There are some other factors, and I mean, some of these you don't address with specific questions in the poll, but I mean, for example, we know that there are a lot of healthcare workers who have decided not to get a vaccination, and a lot of people out there who felt that this was rushed, that they're sitting back and waiting to see if there are any side effects. So there are some other factors other than just political here, but it does stick out that this is something that has become a political issue. Speaking of sticking out, Chris, other than what we've already talked about, was there anything in this poll that when you got the results really jumped out at you as a result that maybe was a surprise or you saw as very significant?
Yeah, there's so much, Scott. And every time you complete a poll and you get the final numbers, you say, wow, that's a little different than I thought, or is something that you're looking forward to seeing. You know, one question that we've asked that has particular salience in debates in Pennsylvania and beyond right now is on the question of marijuana legalization, which we ask, you know, almost every year in this poll. And we've seen the trend line. Rarely do you see, you know, every from poll to poll to poll over years, kind of linear effects that you know, things change linear. Sometimes they jump around based on conditions. This is one issue that we've seen almost literally every year, increases in public support for legalization of marijuana. And it's one of those issues that you look, if you, when we started asking this question almost a decade ago, it's in essence flipped in terms of support and opposition to that. And that's in a fairly short period of time, a decade is pretty noteworthy, I think, anytime I look at that.
Yeah, 58% said that they support legalizing marijuana in Pennsylvania. When you talk about that flip and you've talked about that change, over what period of time are you referencing, since the beginning of your poll 9 years ago or just what?
Yeah, over that time period. We did ask it before in kind of, you know, spotty form back between 2000 and 2010, but asking it in this particular frame that we've asked over and over every year. So it's that last decade. And again, in only a decade, when you look at that, Scott, the kind of the evolution of public views on marijuana, to see the change, if you will, in a relatively short period of time. I'm looking at the numbers right now. When we started asking this question in 2013, only 33% of Pennsylvania said they support, 40% opposed. As you just mentioned, in 2021, you know, 9 polls later, we see it at 58% and opposition at 26%. And so, and the rise is year by year, right? Going up from 33 to 38 to 39 to 45, all the way up to 58% now. So it's quite striking when you see it on a graph.
The legislature is dealing with this issue right now. In fact, let me just get a plug in for tomorrow's show. We will be talking about legalization of marijuana on tomorrow's Smart Talk. But this has been pushed by the Democratic governor, especially by the Democratic lieutenant governor, and mostly Democrats in the legislature. Republican leadership in the legislature has said, no way, non-starter, not going to happen. What about your poll? What breakdown does it show along party lines?
Yeah, it is an issue that, of course, we see some degree of partisanship, but not as stark as we might see in the legislature. Support for recreational legalization, basically, of marijuana in the state. There are some divides, Democrats more likely than Republicans within the state, but those divides aren't as substantial as we see on other issues. If I were looking through this poll, on other issues like fracking and climate change and those, you know, kind of impacts on public health. This one, those divides are narrower, and the support is, again, you know, it, of course it matters within a district, a legislative district, but it's when you start getting up to that level where you're hitting, you know, near 60% support for something, it starts to have kind of a broader impact into lots and lots of districts across the state. And the trend line is important. I don't think you would see a Pennsylvania governor or lieutenant governor out in front of this or with positions on this issue if they were way out in front of public opinion on this. They're not. They're more in line with public opinion right now than they are in front of or changing public opinion. And I think that's an important point to note as the issue goes forward. Now, that doesn't mean that the legislature is going to jump quick at this. It rarely does, and anybody that studies Pennsylvania politics knows we're not usually on the cutting edge of such issues. But certainly those trend lines that we're seeing indicate the public's moving in one direction on this topic.
And it seems as though more Republicans in general would like to toke legally than those in the legislature. So that's just an observation there. But anyway. Getting back to some COVID findings, President Biden has been in office for 3 months. You found that a majority, 54%, approve of how he's handling the pandemic. But the result of this that kind of strikes me is Governor Wolf doesn't fare as well. 41% of those polled disapprove of how Governor Wolf has handled the pandemic. Now, it is very close. I mean, basically evenly split, but 40% who approve of how the governor has handled this. So, as I said, an even split of how the governor has handled the pandemic compared to President Biden.
Yeah, it's clear that they're viewed in different ways by the adults in Pennsylvania. President Biden gets good results. And again, it's a much shorter time frame. Now, you know, we did this poll in about 3 weeks ago. And so it was looking at a few months of President Biden's presidency on and his handling of this issue. And then during that time frame, you saw the rollout of lots of vaccines. You know, COVID relief bill passed, lots of activity. And I think those things have largely resonated with the public in a positive way. Tom Wolf has been, you know, governor during the whole span of this crisis in the Commonwealth over the last year, and has taken on some significant hits, I think, in his public standing as he's governed during a crisis. And we often see that. He's had to make decisions that are often unpopular, affect people's freedoms, affect people's businesses, affect how we live our lives. You know, I think there was a recognition by many Pennsylvanians that was necessary to fight a historic pandemic. But nonetheless, I think the wear and tear, if you will, on the governor's standing and his use burning of lots of capital in kind of a political sense has taken a toll. And right now, Pennsylvanians are highly divided on how he's addressed and how he's handled this crisis.
Along those lines, we have a comment from a listener. It says, my parent has been well protected by her Central Pennsylvania nursing home throughout the pandemic. However, the facility is currently locked down again due to a positive case, which we expect is an unvaccinated staff member. From a public health perspective, how do you balance staff freedom of choice with residents' rights to visit with family and friends? Now, Chris, you are not in a position to probably answer that question, but I bring it up because it is something that it relates to a couple questions in your poll. First of all, what we were just talking about how Governor Wolf has handled the pandemic and rules that have been set in place by the state. And secondly, as the listener said, a staff member who has decided not to get vaccinated, but yet is working with a vulnerable population, and that decision has an impact on locking down a whole nursing home. So, you know, it shows that the questions that you're asking have real world impacts.
They do. Scott, and the question's so good, and the comment's so good, because it cuts right to kind of the trade-offs. I'm going to go right from this interview to my public health policy class that I teach, and we start that class right. I said everybody. I start off. Anybody against public health? Of course not. Everybody wants to see a healthy community, a healthy society, but often the policy avenues to get us to that place challenge individual freedoms or come up against individual freedoms, which we value and are core to our American ideals. And so how do we manage that? How do those decisions get made? What trade-offs are made? And we've lived that over the last year. It used to seem much more of an academic exercise when I taught this class and try to, you know, frame those conflict points. You know, when goods, I say this to my students, when good things clash, things we value, right, our health and our freedoms, how do we decide which one kind of comes out in any particular case ahead? And this is an example of that individual, you know, if indeed it was claiming this is their right, how does that juxtapose against the broader public good? And when do we decide that the public good overwhelms an individual freedom? It's a great example.
Well, and, you know, something you didn't ask in the poll, but it brings up another issue of whether an employer or a college or university can require employees to get vaccinated. And, you know, that's a whole other debate. I want to move on to some other questions, Chris. 61% say it is the federal government's responsibility to make sure everyone has health insurance. But another question you asked to follow up. A universal health care plan, Medicare for all, 27% strongly favor, 27% strongly oppose. Now, a little more somewhat favor, aside from this 27% that strongly favor and strongly oppose. So, it first of all, almost two-thirds saying that it's the federal government's responsibility to make sure that everyone has health insurance. But when it comes down to Medicare for all, evenly split, and it seems when they say strongly favor and strongly oppose that there are strong opinions on both sides.
Indeed. We've been asking questions on federal policy, federal rules for a number of years, and we've asked this particular question about responsibility, and we've seen that number actually creep up over the last few years, not dramatically, and think about potential survey, just the kind of standard error, but it's gone up from 54% in 2019 to 61% now. So it's 2-1 margin of people say it is a federal responsibility, and that's pretty big. So that's kind of on the theoretical big level, but then you have to translate that into policy. What options are there? Do you believe that a Medicare for All program where, you know, the federal government is the single payer, for example, versus that the federal government offers a public option? And we see much more support for, I guess, it's significant, but more gradual idea of the federal government offering individuals the right to buy into Medicare rather than offer a one size, you know, one government single payer Medicare program that is Medicare for all, if you will, which is much more, as you mentioned, Scott, divisive when we get to it. So the public generally thinks the federal government has a responsibility. They tend to favor more options where the federal government is offering a public option on the market for people to buy into, but not necessarily sold on an idea of a universal healthcare. So it's kind of nuanced when you get into the policy details.
Okay, so let me read that question specifically. An optional government-administered health plan similar to Medicare that would be open to anyone but would allow people to keep the coverage they have if they prefer. 32% strongly favor, 46% somewhat favor, 8% strongly oppose, 8% somewhat oppose. I have to say, Chris, that now it's not exactly, but that sounds an awful lot like Obamacare. I mean, what you're talking about here, a government-administered health plan.
Well, it is, Scott, and we've asked many questions, as you could guess, over the years in this particular annual survey on the Affordable Care Act and Obamacare, and we actually saw, you know, support for that increase over the period from when we started as it became popular, at least more popular, and especially particular elements of Obamacare. But it also has kind of resonance in the contemporary debates. This is the position that Joe Biden largely took last year as a candidate, especially in the Democratic debates, where you saw folks like Elizabeth Warren and Bernie Sanders much more in favor of the Medicare for All proposal, if you will, while Biden stuck closer to this policy option that we asked in this and framed in this question, where he said, look, you know, you can buy in to Medicare. You could buy in these. He's put proposals out about earlier buy-in, earlier eligibility and other factors, but largely open it more to Americans to have access to Medicare, which is a very popular program, not only in our poll, but in other polls has been shown, and have that opportunity. And that was the sweet spot. And I think from a political perspective, you know, it was a good move on Biden's part to kind of stake out background, especially in the general election, where I think lots of challenges came, right, that he was trying to nationalize healthcare. And he said, no, I'm not. I'm trying to open it up for individuals to if they want, buy into Medicare.
You ask about health risk and what the public thinks about, I'm going to list three of them in particular: obesity, fracking, four of them, climate change, and Lyme disease. What did the public generally say about those four issues?
Yeah, you know, we every year put in a battery of potential public health risks, that issues that may have impact. Of course, obesity has been at the top of public health professionals' concern level. We have a major issue with this in the United States, and most Pennsylvanians think it's a major risk. 71% kind of aligned with the literature and the science on this. Much more divided on an issue like fracking. 27% said a major risk, 32% minor risk, and 16% said not sure. No risk. A quarter said not sure. I think that's with that issue one of the highest ones that we have, a percentage. Climate change, you see more individuals now linking it as a public health concern. Almost half, 48% of Pennsylvanians said that they think it is a major risk, and another 24% minor risk. It's an issue that seems to be connected much clearer in people's minds. And Lyme disease, as we know, kind of these particular issues that have high levels of significance in a place like Pennsylvania. You see 38% said a major risk and 48% a minor risk. So it's interesting to see how we kind of evaluate the risk associated with a number of issues. And we do this every year with different issues, and sometimes we come back and check them again.
Well, it's interesting findings, Chris. Dr. Christopher Boric is professor of political science and director of Nuremberg College's Institute of Public Opinion. Chris, I don't want to make your students wait. I know they're chomping at the bit to get started in a class, but, you know, thank you very much for being with us today, Chris.
Oh, thanks, Scott. I'm sure they'd be happy if I kept talking here, but I'll turn to my attention to them. Thanks so much.
All right. You're listening to Smart Talk on WITF, your home for NPR News and all. Pennsylvania's 18 electoral votes put Joe Biden in the White House last November. However, former President Donald Trump and his allies falsely claimed the election was wrought with fraud, and others said irregularities from the Department of State should have kept the state's votes from being certified. They filed numerous lawsuits to try and stop the state's votes from being counted, and they lost, all but one lawsuit. But the state's taxpayers lost as well, as the Department of State had to pay more than $3 million to defend itself in court. WITF's All Things Considered host Julia Agos checked the receipts and reported on the lawsuit spending. Julia Agos joins us on today's Smart Talk. Julia, welcome to the program.
Morning. Thanks for having me, Scott.
If you have a question or a comment, give us a call, 1-800-729-7532. Send an email to smarttalk@witf.org. On Twitter, we are at smarttalkwitf. Again, that phone number, 1-800-729-7532. So, Julia, how did this story begin?
Yeah, so Scott, you know, as you know, we have conversations in our editorial meetings all the time about accountability stories and how can we bring new information to light for our listeners. And I'm sure you remember, you know, in November and December, it was all about lawsuits all the time. And we were sort of waiting to see how many of them would play out in court. And that intensity sort of led us to wonder what the long-term consequences of these lawsuits would be. And, you know, because of the coronavirus pandemic and all of the adjustments the Department of State had to make already, we knew that their budgets would be tight. And it led us to wonder, you know, how much these lawsuits, what kind of financial impact they would have on the department. And as you said in the intro, it was significant. It was over, it was about $3.4 million were spent on defending against lawsuits by any group or political party. It wasn't just those post-election lawsuits, but those, again, from Trump and his allies did have a significant impact.
All right, well, let's talk about those, because I know there are going to be those who will think that this was all post-election and all Trump and allies, but there were a few others that the Department of State had to defend against. What were those?
Yeah. So as you said, it wasn't just Trump and his allies. You know, in the story we talk about in May, the Libertarian Party took the Department of State to court asking for, you know, there's a statute that says third party candidates, in order to get on the ballot, need to have in-person signatures. And they were arguing that because of the COVID-19 pandemic, that they should, there should be an exception to that rule. And the Department of State ended up winning that case, but it went on to cost the department a significant amount of money in order to defend against that lawsuit. And I'm trying to find the numbers here. Let's see, the Libertarian Party, that was about $172,000 that the Department of State had to spend to defend against that suit. There were others. Pennsylvania Democrats took the department to court in a suit that cost about $87,000. So, you know, there was a spectrum of what the defense cost, but it's important to remember that, you know, the department has in-house counsel, but because of the intensity of this election cycle, they contracted with outside lawyers. And so the costs that we're referring to is money spent in order to defend with outside counsel.
I'm sure that was one of the questions many people would have, is knowing that the Department of State had in-house counsel, why it was costing taxpayers more than $3 million. But you just answered that question, is that they did have to contract with outside law firms. So getting back to, you mentioned, just listed that there were a couple others, but the majority of these cases involve post-election President Trump, former President Trump, and his allies filing suit. Your story begins with Pennsylvania's Republican U.S. Senator Pat Toomey calling on Trump to accept the election results in late November. Why use that as a jumping off point?
Yeah, so we wanted to find a way to sort of, you know, present a timeline for people as they were reading this story. You know, election litigation is not uncommon. There is a cost associated with running an election every year and defending against, you know, litigation is often used to clarify technicalities in law. So, for example, we had the issue of mail-in ballots coming in after the election. If they were postmarked on election day, coming in after the election, that was litigated in court. We used Toomey's statement because the Republican senator was a supporter of President Trump. He voted for him and advocated for his reelection. And as we point out in the story, 2 weeks after the election was called for Biden, Toomey had seen enough. He said that the president had exhausted all plausible legal avenues in pursuing his cases, and said that it was time to accept Biden as the winner. So we use that in order to kind of, as I said, present a timeline for people where, you know, you have a supporter of President Trump, an avid supporter, saying that we've crossed a line in these lawsuits, and now it's time to accept the results and move on.
So how did former President Trump and his allies justify bringing these lawsuits?
Well, Republicans and Trump and his allies said that they were angry at DOS decisions over things like the mail-in ballot extension deadline. Another example would be allowing voters to cure or fix mistakes on their ballot. So maybe they didn't sign a specific line or issues with their ballot. Trump and his allies were angry with those decisions and said, Congressman Mike Kelly's lawsuit said that the decision by DOS violated the state constitution. And so they use these cases to air their grievances in court. But what we point out in the story is that the judges that were making the decisions in these cases used some pretty extreme language when issuing their decisions, calling some of these lawsuits baseless or without merit. As we point out in the story, that these lawsuits went further than the typical, technicalities that they were trying to, that a lot of other election litigation is often trying to clarify.
Well, you anticipated my next question. I mean, how do the lawsuits this year compare with previous elections, especially previous presidential elections?
Right. So we asked the Department of State for a little bit more clarity on how these compared to previous years. And a DOS spokeswoman said that they were higher than previous years, but didn't go into further detail about how they compared. And then in my conversation with former Secretary Kathy Buchvar, she confirmed that the litigation was the amount of cases was higher than previous years, but we weren't able to get specific detail from the department about how these lawsuits compared to previous years. But we do know that the costs were higher and that the number was higher.
Let's take a phone call from Fred in Lingolstown. Fred, you're on the air.
Hi, Scott. Thanks for taking my call.
Yes, you're welcome.
What I'm interested in is how do we cut down on frivolous suits without impinging on people's rights to challenge the actions of the government? I mean, it seems that even if you do things like require some kind of a bond, that if the judge decides your suit is totally frivolous, you would forfeit, would still impinge on people's rights. So I will hang up and listen, and if you can just touch on that a little bit.
Okay, Fred, thank you very much for your call. Julia, I know that this is something that you did talk about. I mean, we could expand that question to, Fred's question is, how do you, reduce the number of frivolous lawsuits, but not impinge on people's rights when there's something that they see as wrong? But in this particular case, did judges consider some of these lawsuits frivolous to begin with? And then maybe you can address Fred's question in particular.
Yeah, I mean, it's a great question, Fred. And that's why that was something we spent a lot of time talking about. I spoke with the director of Common Cause Pennsylvania, who addressed this issue. It's something that they've been talking about since observing, the extent of these lawsuits. And their idea is implementing some type of inspector general or third party investigator who could address these lawsuits on the front end to prevent taxpayers from having to foot the bill. If that board, they said it could be multiple people or one person. If that inspector general determines that the lawsuit is meritless, then the plaintiffs would have to pay for legal bills. I raised that example when I was speaking with Secretary Buchvar, and she says that she feels that sanctions and recovering legal fees after the lawsuits are concluded would be a more prudent way of going about it in order to protect that right of bringing suit. In my conversations with everyone for this story, people wanted to make sure that they were very clear that No one is advocating for eliminating election litigation. They all say that this is a really important part of government, and taxpayers, in a lot of cases, should have skin in the game when it comes to paying for legal defense in election litigation. But it's when those lawsuits cross into, you know, as we said, the frivolous territory, that Fred's question is exactly right. How do we prevent that? And I think that that's something that, you know, government reform groups are going to be looking at in the months and years to come, especially if we see something like this happen again.
You know, along those lines, there was a quote from one of the judges, and this was a federal judge, that said, just making claims of fraud doesn't make it so. In other words, what he was saying, if you read between the lines, is this is not a suit that should be, have been brought before this court, because you have no evidence. And that's what many of these cases, almost all of these cases, found, is that there was no evidence of fraud. Now, you know, as far as the actions of the Department of State and the Pennsylvania Supreme Court, you know, those are legitimate questions that a court could decide. But, you know where I'm getting at here, Julia, is that that quote has been probably repeated most often, that saying that there's fraud doesn't make it so.
That's exactly right. Yeah, you're referring to a decision from Judge Stefanos Bibas on November 27th. So just a week after Senator Pat Toomey issued his statement, you know, accepting Biden as the win. And he said, charges of unfairness are serious, but calling an election unfair does not make it so. Charges require specific allegations and then proof. And we have neither here. And, you know, Secretary Bookvar pointed to that quote in my interview with her when she stated that she thinks that the legal system was abused during this election cycle. And, you know, the people that I spoke to for this story made the connection between the extensive election litigation that happened, especially after the election, and the former president's narrative or lie that he won the election, that there was fraud. And, you know, they said that these lawsuits were used to push that narrative. And I think that's also why, you know, people were concerned about how extensive these lawsuits were, because it wasn't just costs, like monetary costs to the department. There were others as well, and that came in the form of, you know, pushing the former president's election fraud lie.
You're listening to Smart Talk on WITF, your home for NPR News and all things regional. I'm Scott Lamar. Coming up on tomorrow's Smart Talk, we will be talking about legislation to make marijuana, recreational marijuana, legal in Pennsylvania. We will have a Republican state senator who has introduced legislation to make it legal. Also, we'll hear from someone who feels that it is not a good move. And we will hear from those who have reported on what Pennsylvania surrounding states are doing when it comes to legalization of marijuana. That's coming up on tomorrow's program. Today we are joined by WITF's All Things Considered host and journalist Julia Agos. She recently reported on the amount of money the state spent to defend itself against election-related lawsuits. If you have a question or a comment, give us a call, 1-800-729-7532. Send an email to smarttalk@witf.org. On Twitter, we are at SmartTalkWITF. Again, that phone number, 1-800-729-7532. Julie, we have a question from a Millersville University student who wants to know, and I don't know whether you get into this, but in the course of talking with some of the people you write about in the story, report on, with all the turmoil in last year's election, what will the future of voting look like? And I guess we could maybe add on to that question by asking it specifically to these lawsuits. Has there anything come out of these lawsuits that would make a change in how Pennsylvanians vote in the future?
You know, Scott, I think that's an interesting question. I don't know how these lawsuits would affect the way people vote. But as I was saying earlier, I do think that these lawsuits had an impact on people's perception of voting. And it wasn't just lawsuits. It was the entire narrative of, you know, fraud and mail-in ballot fraud that may make people, you know, wary or skeptical of voting. And I think that's partially why the people that I spoke to for this story, why they were, you know, in the first place willing to talk, but then also wanted to talk about solutions, because, you know, we want to make sure people have confidence in the democratic process and confidence in their vote. And, you know, again, because there was no evidence of fraud, I think people will be looking at ways to not increase confidence because there was an issue, but eliminate ways in which people can push false narratives. And I don't know how that would happen, but, you know, we saw the way that the legal system was used in this previous election. And so I do think there will be conversations like the ones that are happening at Common Cause and, you know, like the one that I had with Secretary of State Kathy Buchvar about how do we prevent this from happening again? How do we prevent the legal system from being co-opted for so that someone can hold on to power? And Scott, as we pointed out in the story, the former president admitted to wanting to using the legal system to hold on to power. In a Fox News interview on March 16th, he said, "Our Supreme Courts and our courts did not have the courage to overturn elections." And so I think, you know, it's very clear that the legal system was co-opted so that he could hold on to power. And I think if there's any reform, it'll be in trying to prevent that from happening again.
And what it also shows, if the former president believes that to be the case, that it was just judges not having courage, it also shows that maybe a lack of understanding of the legal system. The judges make decisions based on law, or at least that's supposed to be how it happens. You know, I want to get back to the cost, though. One of the big questions that I'm sure a lot of people have is, why are taxpayers on the hook here? I mean, you explained that the Department of State had to go outside of house. We understand that part of it. But in a lot of civil cases, when a lawsuit is filed, if a judge throws it out or rules against that party that filed the suit, they have to pony up. They have to pay for that. Why doesn't it happen in this case? These cases, I should say.
Yeah, well, we know that one governor, Governor Tony Evers of Wisconsin, which was also the target of Trump and his allies' lawsuits, Governor Evers is seeking legal fees to be repaid to his state. They, their Department of State paid $144,000 to defend against Trump's lawsuits. And so he is asking a judge to order Trump and his lawyers to repay those costs to the state. Now, the Wolf administration is not currently seeking sanctions or trying to recover legal fees. And that is a question that we asked and was they did not want to answer that question. But I do think it is it's a good point. You know, why are taxpayers on the hook for, you know, as we pointed out, $3.4 million of election litigation defense money? I don't have the answer to that.
And your story just dropped last week. Just yesterday, the U.S. Supreme Court decided not to hear a case from Pennsylvania election related. So are these costs of $3.4 million? Will there be additional costs added on to that?
Yeah, so the case yesterday was an issue going back to that mail-in ballot deadline extension. The Pennsylvania Supreme Court had ruled that counties needed to accept those ballots that were postmarked by Election Day and that arrived within the 3 days following, accept and count them. And this was a case that made it up to its way up to the Supreme Court on appeal. And the reason why it sounds like the case was so drawn out is that the Supreme Court justices had requested additional briefing that took a bit more time And they refused to hear that case and ordered the lower court to dismiss it as moot. So yes, the answer to your question is that we can assume that there were additional costs given the fact that it had already been litigated extensively. I don't know how much more the cost would be, but that's one reason why the story dropped, you know, last week, is that we wanted to get a full picture of the election litigation. We wanted to wait until, you know, one of the most high profile case was probably Representative Kelly's challenge to Act 77, which didn't conclude until the end of February. So we wanted to wait until most of the lawsuits concluded and then request those invoices. And that's partially why, you know, we're in April talking about an election that happened in November.
Well, speaking of that Kelly case, and is that the one that was the most expensive?
It was one of the most expensive. So the Department of State spent about $320,000 on Act 77 advice. And this is another one of those issues that we asked for clarification on, and they did not want to give us that. But Representative Kelly's case challenged Act 77. So the actual cost to defend against his case was about $64,000. But then, as we said, that the department was getting advice on how to handle Act 77 well before the election, and that was that $320,000 bill. So, you know, Kelly's cost was kind of wrapped into both of those as they were getting legal advice for issues related to Act 77 even before Kelly's lawsuit was filed.
What was the most expensive one?
The most expensive lawsuit was labeled as a Trump campaign matter, which between various documents we interpreted as the case called Trump versus Bookvar. And that accounted for about $1.5 million. That was a case that was extended before, it was established before the election and extended after. And that, $1.5 million, it required quite a bit of resources to defend against.
Mm-hmm. You mentioned that you spoke with the former Secretary of State, Kathy Bookvar, who has been criticized by Republicans for giving out inconsistent advice when it came to curing some of the mail-in ballots. And she has been a target of criticism for Republicans since the election. And also, and a lot of people would look at this and say that her credibility was hurt when the Department of State did not advertise the constitutional amendment about sexual abuse and opening a two-year window. So, you know, when you talk with Secretary Bookvar, what was the sense you got? I mean, was she defensive? Was she bitter? Were you at all concerned about her credibility with the attacks that she was getting?
You know, I think I separated the issue over which she resigned, which you referred to, Scott. There was an issue with advertising a constitutional amendment that she seemed to, you know, take the blame for. I don't know how involved she was with that particular issue, but it's important to remember that she resigned over an issue that was not related to election issues. So those criticisms from Republicans did not amount to her resignation. You know, I think that there are fair criticisms, and then I think that there are some that were connected to, as we've been saying, these election-related lawsuits that pushed the former president's false narrative of voter fraud. And so I didn't question her credibility as it related to her resignation issue, but, you know, as reporters, we're always wary and we want to ask tough questions. And so, you know, we made sure to cover an array of issues with her, but stayed focused on the election issues.
Mm-hmm. We're almost out of time, Julia. Great work on this story. And by the way, if you didn't get a chance to read Julia's story, we have a link to it on our website, WITF.org/smarttalk. Julia, you know, the thing about the story that I wanted to mention in the 30 seconds or less that we have is that you had to jump through a few hoops, if you will, to get this information, and you were the first journalist to do it, as far as I know. How did you get this information?
Well, you know, we have the right to know request law in Pennsylvania, which allowed us to request these invoices. And then it was just a lot of badgering. As you know, that's what we do as journalists, Scott, right? You got to keep asking follow-up questions and, you know, put the pressure on to make sure that we get a full picture of what happened.
Julia Agos is WITF's All Things Considered host and obviously a great journalist. Julia, thank you very much for being with us today.
Thanks for having me, Scott.
I'm Scott Lamar. Have yourself a great day.